Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher, current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so on this podcast, we explore ideas and strategies. I share some of my big epic fails that I've made on this journey. I share stories of what worked as well. And I also interview experts. And one of the topics we get into a lot on this podcast is project-based learning. So I'm excited today to have as our guest a really good friend of mine who is a true PBL expert. He is an international keynote speaker. He does amazing PBL workshops. He has great videos. If you ever get a chance to see them, you've probably already seen one of his videos, even if you didn't realize it. They're highly inspirational, but they're also very practical. He does amazing, epic projects, and now he's in a role where he is supporting teachers. He teaches part-time at a university and does a lot of professional development with teachers. And so without further ado, I want to introduce you to this interview that I did with Trevor Muir. I'll edit that out. All right, we have with us here Trevor Muir. He is a true PBL expert. One of the fun things with Trevor is I've talked to a lot of different experts in project-based learning, but Trevor is someone where I actually twice got a chance to see you teach. And so I know that Trevor is the real deal when it comes to project-based
learning. Yeah, that's going way back that you came and visited my classroom. And I remember I always showed that group of students every Friday we would do one of your writing prompts. And that's how, like, how we would like kick off Fridays by doing like a really fun writing prompt. And then I remember the day that you came in on a Friday for a conference at our school. We did the writing prompt and I was like, oh, by the way, guys, the person who comes up with these prompts is standing next to me. And it was kind of like them, it kind of blew their minds a little bit. So that was fun.
I love it. That was so much fun. And gosh, they had such thoughtful answers. I remember doing the to-do list of a villain, and it was great. It was so great. Well, I want to talk to you a little bit about this idea of authenticity in project-based learning. And so just to kind of start with, when you think about the notion of project-based learning, what it is to do PBL, for people that are new to it, for people who aren't that familiar, how would you generally define
PBL? Yeah, you know, PBL? What I always say about PBL is it's really just purpose-based learning. Like, it's really trying to figure out how can I give purpose to what my students are learning. And so, like, when I work with teachers on how to do project-based learning, sometimes we call it project-based learning. Sometimes it's like, oh, here's another thing I'm going to have to learn, or here's something that I'm going to have to replace what I already do really well. Because here's this new fad in education. And I always start off by saying, like, really, you can call it whatever you want. At its core, it's about how can we help students see the relevance in what they're learning? Can we give them real problems to solve? And in order to solve it, we're going to have to learn this content or develop these skills or work together or whatever it is, because there's problems that actually matter to students. And so that's what project-based learning is to me as a teacher and somebody who helps people learn how to do it, is how can I find relevant problems that matter to my students that they're going to be willing to put in the work and collaborate with others or sit through the direct instruction or do the practice or do the research or interview the professionals in order to solve this problem. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I think it's interesting that you said that, because I think for a lot of teachers, they hear about project-based learning and it feels completely overwhelming. And one of the things that you and I have both talked about privately is this idea of, if a teacher is starting the journey of PBL, it really helps to begin with this question: what am I already doing that's similar to PBL? So I want to sit there for just a moment. What do you think a lot of teachers are already doing
that connects to PBL? I mean, PBL at its core is about inquiry as well, like raising questions with your students and getting them to wonder about things. That's what good teachers do already. It gets kids inspired to want to learn and ask big questions and want to dive deeper. And so really with PBL, it's really about just framing those questions on a specific problem that again matters to students. Like, so for instance, I worked with this third grade teacher not too long ago, and she had a whole learning unit all on invasive species. And that's something that's typical. It's in the next gen science standards. Third graders have to learn about invasive species anyway. And so then it's like, okay, how can you get your students to want to learn about invasive species? Because, you know, for some kids, learning about invasive species for the sake of learning about it is fine, right? Like, I've got a son who's just deeply interested in everything right now. Mm-hmm. He's a 7-year-old and he just wants to learn about everything. So yeah, some kids are just going to learn about it because it's something to learn. Some kids might learn about it because there's a grade attached to it and there's pressures behind that, and that might motivate some kids. But there's a lot of students who could care less about the grades and could care less about invasive species, right? And so what this teacher ended up planning was she took her students to a park across from the school that the kids often played at, and she had them notice and observe all of the different plants that are growing in the park, and then had them make hash marks next to the plant that they saw the most of. And it turns out the one that they saw more than anything else is this one called garlic mustard, which is like an invasive species. So then she came back together and said, guys, did you see this garlic mustard? This is actually an invasive species. It doesn't belong at our park, and it's destroying all of the other plants in our park here that you like to play in. It's actually destroying your play space. What should we do about this? So she presented them a problem that actually connects with their own lives. And then through a whole bunch of different inquiry and empowering activities and brainstorming, they came up with the idea of, let's have an event where we invite people to come out and pull these invasive species. But if we're going to get people to show up on a Saturday to pull weeds, we're going to have to make them understand why invasive species are a problem. So let's do some research and figure out why invasive species are a problem. Let's create posters and PSA videos and craft really good persuasive emails that we can send to parents, and let's invite the community out. Let's educate ourselves so that we can educate others so that we can get rid of these invasive species. So that teacher, it's like, all right, I was going to teach invasive species anyway. We were going to get into cell structure and what makes plants grow. And we were going to get into all this content. I was going to have them do writing and reading and research. But now there's a good reason for doing it. Like, I'm still doing the things that work best. I think a lot of misconceptions with PBL is that I have to abandon best practices in order to do this. And it's like, actually, no, you're now just giving a good reason for those best practices. Now students are understanding why I'm sitting through a lecture on invasive species, because what I'm learning from this lecture and what I'm learning from the practice that's going after it can be applied to solving this problem that actually matters to me. And that to me is what PBL is at its core.
So when you think about it, you know, a lot of people who look at PBL, they think about PBL, it can be kind of overwhelming because you suddenly get all of this language of, you know, it has to have a driving question, it has to have defining questions, it has to have this, it has to have this. What would you say to that teacher who says, look, I want to do an authentic project, I want to do PBL, I see all these different protocols that we're told you're supposed to do if you use PBL. But I'm looking at my students right now and I'm saying they need some work on skills. They need some conceptual understanding. They need some direct instruction. They need some of these things that we've currently been doing. And, you know, when I tried to dive in and do this project and use all these protocols, it just fell flat.
Yeah.
And I hear that a lot, right? People who they try to go dive in and do this big project and they use all those things, the need to knows and the, you know, all these different structures. Yeah. What would you say to that teacher?
I would say, first off, that those protocols are supposed to be helpful. You know what I mean? And so if they're not helpful, then don't use them. Mm-hmm. Like the driving question is really that big question that students are trying to answer throughout the project. And often when I'm doing projects, I'm revisiting that driving question throughout the project. I can say, okay, guys, we're going to revisit that big question. How do we eliminate invasive species at our parks? And today we're going to learn about how to answer that question by doing this. And it's something that's kind of continuing to remind students why they're doing this work. But you know what? Sometimes I don't need to repeat the driving question over and over. Or, you know, sometimes we do the entry event. We're going to do the field trip where we go and see the invasive species, and we have a protocol afterward called knows and need to knows. Let's state everything we know about the problem and everything we need to know to solve it. Sometimes it's all really obvious what we're trying to solve, and we don't need to do that whole process. Instead, it can be like, all right, guys, we have these invasive species. You are going to organize an event that's going to get rid of them. And this is what we're going to do. We don't need to go through all those processes all the time. Sometimes they're really helpful. And so for one, I'd say to teachers, those are supposed to be helpful. And if they're not helpful, maybe dig into why and maybe refine it and iterate a bit or skip it. Again, it's really all about, is there this umbrella of authenticity over student work? Do students understand why they're doing the work? And to me, if you can answer that, if you can say, yep, students know that they're creating this project, they're solving this problem, they're doing this collaboration, they're learning this content so that they can do something that's meaningful to them. If you can answer that, that to me is what PBL is. I think everything else are just processes to help it go smoothly and work better.
I'm going to hone in on this idea of authenticity for a second. One of the things that struck me when I visited you was how eager students were to tell stories of the experiences they had had in doing PBL. And I think one of the things that I noticed was that you were intentional about designing PBL in a way where you were designing an experience rather than just designing a unit plan. And so I would love if you would speak into this idea of what does it mean for a teacher to be really intentional about designing the experience of PBL rather than just the learning segments, the unit plans, the lesson plans.
I mean, we never forget good stories, right? Like stories that we hear or that we read or that we watch or that we tell. We don't forget good stories. We also don't forget stories that we experience, right? Like we, at its core, stories are part of what it means to be human. It's in our neurological makeup that we respond and remember really well-told stories. And so when I think about PBL, it's really just a good story. Right? It's got that defined beginning, middle, and end. You've got that introduction of a problem at the beginning. You've got the rising action, all of the work that goes into solving the problem. And then at the end, you've got that authentic presentation of some type. That's the climax of the story, right? That's where resolution comes from. Mm-hmm. You know, when I had my students go and interview World War II veterans, like there's your exposition. We're learning from these heroes in our community. And then we spent a whole month learning about World War II and reading books like Night by Elie Wiesel and Soldier Boys and the graphic novel Mouse. And we're crafting their stories and we're putting them together into these things. And then at the end of that project, we had this big presentation where we showed student work to the community, showcasing the lives and stories of these veterans. That's the climax. That's what it was all building to. And so like when I see students at the grocery store years later and they come up to me and they're like, hey, Mr. Muir. And I'm like, hey, you, there you are. they always, you know, it's really fun to catch up for a minute, but almost every time they want to tell me about one of these stories they were a part of. They're like, oh, Mr. Muir, I still think about that World War II project. Matter of fact, one of my former students, Josh, emailed me yesterday. He went on my website and found my email. I got an email from a kid, Josh, from like 7 years ago saying, hey, Mr. Muir, do you still have a copy of my World War II documentary that we made? And I'm like, this is a guy who's a young professional now. He's like 24 years old and working in industry. And I'm thinking of this on the spot. I didn't even make this connection when I got his email. I'm like, this kid remembers that story that happened to him, right? That was an experience. And yet I bet he also remembers the details of the story because we don't forget the details that are a part of a good story, right? Like we remember being mad at Rose for not scooting over on the door when there was more than enough room for her and Jack to survive the Titanic, right? Like we remember it because it was part of a story, even though that story came out 24 years ago. Feel old yet? Right? Yeah, like we don't forget that. And Josh could probably still tell you about like the key causes of World War II. He could still tell you about like the Battle of Normandy and the invasion of D-Day. Like those details are still sticking because they were part of something bigger than that. And so to me, that's what authenticity is like, how do we create learning experiences, stories that students can really attach to? But can I say something? It's kind of morphed my view of what authenticity should look like in a PBL project. And that really happened for me last year. My son was in first grade last year, and he came home one day and he was like, Daddy, we're doing project-based learning, which made me really excited because like I went and actually did PD with his teachers. I was like, oh, they're doing it. Yay, this is wonderful. So I was like, tell me about it. And he's like, well, we're creating our dream neighborhoods and groups. And we're going to design our own houses and parks and everything. And then we're going to put it together with the rest of the class and have our dream neighborhood. I was like, that's awesome, bud. And who are you presenting it to? He's like, what do you mean? And I'm trying to ask, like, well, who's the authentic audience? What's making this real? And he goes, well, it's for us. I was like, well, what do you mean? Like, and I'm thinking to myself as the PBL guy, like, are you bringing in, is the teacher bringing in engineers? Are they bringing in city planners? Like, how, what's making this authentic? And he's like, no, we're at the end of the project, we're going to put it together and we're all going to look at it. And I'm thinking to myself privately, I'm like, oh, that teacher wasn't paying attention in my workshop, right? Like, you're missing the authentic piece. But John, like every time my son would come home, I said, hey, how was school today? He's like, awesome. We designed the doors to our houses, or we used shapes and math to create the roof sizes, or we designed the colors. And he's geeking out. And by the end of that project, all this kid could talk about with school was this project he was working on. And it was like a light bulb went off for me, because I was like, you know what? That teacher knows what's authentic to that kid. She knows her students. And you ask, like, what do teachers already do well? They know their students. And that teacher, Mrs. Shansky, knows that a group of first grade kids don't need a team of engineers to come be their authentic audience. That she knows that you don't need this external bust out the walls of the classroom to make this project come alive. In fact, creating something for the sake of creating it and showing it to each other was the authentic audience. And so now I look at a PBL experience and it's like, all right, the first thing you should consider is what is relevant and authentic to your students. Now, if I did that exact project with high school AP city planner or social studies students, they might not like the hypothetical neighborhood as much. Maybe they would, but my students traditionally might need that extra motivation. It might be helpful to bring in a construction expert to look at their designs, or a city planner or an urban planner. That might be that extra boost of authenticity to get, you know, AP high school students going. But I can tell you, at least for my first grade son, it was plenty of authenticity as it was. And that's really shaped my view of what PBL should look like. It's really asking what's authentic to my students.
Well, and I think what's authentic in my experience has a lot to do with what do I find interesting? And what do I have a sense of control over, right? So it's ownership and interest tend to be the biggest factors for me. And so, you mentioned those writing prompts. There is nothing real world and authentic about writing a to-do list for a supervillain, or coming up with what social media conversations would be between pets. But it's authentic to them. Why? Because it's interesting, right? And there's a small sense of ownership. There's that added layer of authenticity, you know, in a PBL unit where you say you're going to get to ask your own questions. You're going to get to find your own answers during research. You get to organize research however you choose to organize it. Could be in, you know, a notebook, note cards, this, that, whatever style works for you. Generating your own original ideas for your project. That sense of ownership, I think, is a lot of times where that authenticity comes from and really drives a lot of it. But I do think there is that next level, and there's nothing wrong to say, hey, authenticity at some point, there really is power in bringing the learning out into the world. And I would, for me, feasibility wise, teaching middle school, low income school, I struggle a little bit with, you know, doing big events and things like that. We really, when it came to PBL, we did mini projects that would be a week, 2 weeks. We kind of layered it, but I would always have a goal of like once a quarter, I'm going to do was all I could do feasibly to have a project with a true authentic audience that goes outside the walls of the classroom. Cause that's all I was capable of doing. Whereas someone else that I worked with, he had a much easier time finding those authentic audiences, planning it, making it happen two or three times in a quarter. So I think there's some of it, like the feasibility aspect of what you're capable of doing as a teacher and what your student,
I think when you think about PBL or school in general, like I think it's really good to help students develop skills that they will use in the quote unquote real world someday. But I also think there's a lot of power in making school the real world. You know what I mean? Like, hey, we're not just going to like hypothetically try to solve problems in the world. What if we solve problems? And in the process, we also developed and honed these skills that we're going to use the rest of our lives. You know, my students learned all about, you know, the plight of refugees as they come to America and struggle to assimilate to different cultural ideas and technologies. And we brought in a guest speaker to share what it was like to come from a refugee camp in Kenya to Grand Rapids, Michigan, and have to learn how to use the city bus and computers and stoves and microwaves. And so she shared about all this. And for the next month, as we learned about the Industrial Revolution and new technologies and culture and modernism and modernity, while we learned about these concepts, my students also created tools that they presented to a social work agency that they would potentially use in their programs. And so that's what they did. They created how-to videos on using the bus and flashcards on how to use household appliances. So it wasn't just like, oh, we're going to hypothetically learn how to serve people. No, we're actually going to serve people. And I got an email just a couple of years after we did that project from that social work agency saying, hey, we're still using these flashcards and we still have the how to use the bus system on loop in the waiting room at one of our social work offices. Like, it's being used and it's serving people. And you know, there's all this body of research that shows that when students are engaged in service learning, meaning the work that they're doing isn't just serving themselves. Yeah, it's serving yourself. But, you know, the best service is selfish. It serves you, but it's also selfless. When students are engaged in that service work, there's measurable growth in their cognitive development, meaning we're not abandoning deeper learning and content academic subject matter. Actually, we're expanding it. When students are learning content because there's a good reason to, and because it's serving something external, actually they can learn content at a deeper level. But then the research also shows there's social development. Students learn to collaborate better when there's a good reason to. There's emotional development. There's less depression, less anxiety when students are doing meaningful work in school. And then, you know, there's also behavioral development. You know, from a practical side as a teacher, it's easier to manage a group of students who knows why they're working on what they're working on. It's that students are better behaved when they're doing work that's serving someone beyond just themselves, which makes sense because we're humans, right? Mm-hmm. Like,
well, and I'm struck by now in particular. You know, one of the things that I'm hearing from so many teachers is students are struggling. Trauma is real. We don't want to deny it. We don't want to pretend like any of that's not the case. And there's a tendency to go, because it's so hard, because this year has been so hard, I just don't know if this is the year to try a project. But part of what I'm hearing is, look, when students engage in meaningful projects, they develop some of those soft skills that we see them currently lacking right now during this pandemic.
I mean, and just going back to the idea of the season that we're in right now as educators, like, I get it. Like, this is a really, really tough time to be a teacher. There's just no sugarcoating that. And, you know, like I went to a school recently to talk about project-based learning and learn how to do it. And I got to tell you, the first hour of the workshop, it kind of felt like, oh, here's another thing I've got to add to my docket in a year where I have no capacity. And I get that. I really did. It was palpable, the feeling in the room. And so a lot of my work that day was helping teachers see that I don't want to add to your burden. Instead, I feel like when you can do PBL well, when you can give students real problems to solve and they learn how to solve those problems together, just like you said, it actually can get rid of some of those issues that we're seeing. Like, you know, lack of student engagement has been one of the most cited things I've heard from teachers lately. Just students just apathetic about being in school and wanting to be on their phones. And, you know, talked to a teacher yesterday who said, like, oh, you know, when students go to the bathroom, it's like they're gone for 30 minutes every time, just wander in hallways. And it's like, well, I get that. What if they were doing a project in school where they were like, I can't go wander the hallway because I got to solve this problem, or I don't want to go wander the hallway because I'm working with my group and we're pumped about what we're working on right now, right? There's something that we're trying to do.
Well, one of the things I'm struck by with authentic PBL, and you see it with your projects that you did, right? And this is where I think an authentic audience authentic research, some of that stuff really, really matters, is if you are going to interview someone who fought in World War II, are you going to leave that interview to go wander the bathroom for the hallway for 30 minutes?
Or most?
Yeah. Or if you have this pressure of this is going to be shown, at a movie theater, are you going to, what it seems, this is to me the value, and I saw this with the way you approached the projects that I witnessed you teaching, is you created a high pressure situation with plenty of freedom to make mistakes and a rehearsal and a revision period ahead of time. So they had these really high standards that they were really wanting to reach because of the authenticity, but then this permission to just fail forward and screw up along the way. And I'm wondering if you could talk to that for a moment. Where do you see that playing out in PBL, the twin notions of high expectations, but also that permission to make mistakes?
One of the key terms you hear often in PBL is student voice and choice or student empowerment. Like, let students make choices and all this. And I'm a firm, firm believer in voice and choice. And I love your book, Empower. And I really believe in those key tenets. But I also, but I can tell you a lot of teachers are like, well, I don't want to give free rein in the classroom because that can become chaotic. And it's like, oh, I agree. And so like what I always try to do in designing projects is like give a structure and a deadline for where things are going, and then provide voice and choice and how you actually get there. You know what I mean? I'll say like, all right, guys, on Veterans Day, we're going to hold this event for World War II veterans. And so we have 1 month to get our stuff there. What are you going to create for that day? And here's some stipulations of what you're going to create. You know, like you've got to make sure that you include a piece of artwork, and it's got to have a podcast component, and there's got to be a film. Now, what your films look like and what you choose to write about and what effects you want to put into the podcast or whatever else the details are, that's up to you and your group, right? Like, and so there's this choice that's still happening, but it's also manageable because, you know, that PBL project, I designed it over the summer. You know what I mean? Like sometimes there's a bit of an illusion with students like that. They're coming up with the whole solution to the project. It's like, oh, actually, no, I've done this project 5 years in a row. Like I know that my students are going to create tools for refugees, but what tools they create is up to them. You're right. There's inquiry driving that. And that's going to involve some failure. That's going to involve iteration. That's going to involve figuring things out as you go. And so, I mean, I think a lot of this, you know, I'll let me say this. Often when I share about examples from my own classrooms with other teachers, whether it's a keynote or a workshop or in my books, when I share about what PBL has looked like, it's often the third year of that project that I'm sharing about, right? Like I'm not usually telling you the story of the first project. Like the first time we did this World War II project, I didn't have time to review the films before the big showcase. And I was like, oh, well, I'll show them. The kids have been working hard. I'm sure they're good. And they were good. And we had like 400 people show up to this event, and all the veterans sat in the front row as the guests of honor. And so it was brilliant, except the audio, because this was like 2011, the audio on their films was awful. And so for an hour and a half, we sat there and it just sounded like this. And it was like an hour and a half of just listening to mumbling. I was like, oh, so you know what? Year two, I'm going to require students put in subtitles. So if the audio isn't good, we can still read what the veterans are saying. So we did that. I didn't review their subtitles, and we got there, and you better believe people could read what the veterans were saying, but there were a lot of words that were misspelled, and the word "you" was spelled with the letter U, and like nobody capitalized an I, and there wasn't a period or a comma in sight. And it was like mortifying. Like I remember after the event, a veteran came up to me with his walker and he said, "I tell you what, Teach, thank you very much for this. This was special, but boy, do you got to teach those kids how to spell." And I'm like, oh, it was like, no, like, come on. And it's like, it pointed out why grammar and spelling is important. It's distracting. So you know what we did in year three? I tied in my entire spelling and grammar unit into that project. So now while we're creating these documentaries and all this work, we're also doing a little bit of drill and kill on spelling and grammar, because that's sometimes the best way to teach grammar. I'm going to demonstrate it on the board. You're going to practice. I'm going to demonstrate. You practice. It can look very traditional. But now, as you're learning in spelling and grammar, it's not because it was in the Common Core. It's not because there's a grade attached to it. It's because we want to honor these veterans. And if we don't have great spelling and grammar, it's going to distract from that. And so, like, you know what I mean? So, like, that's year three of the project. And, like, do I wish I could have learned that lesson in year one? Of course. But I learned it through failure myself, right? Like, the project didn't go smoothly the first time, but it definitely went better the second time.
Well, and it's, I'm struck by, like, when you say that, there's also that notion of, you know, we were, well-intentioned people said to us when we were new teachers, pre-service teachers, you know, oh, don't be that teacher that repeats the same lesson year after year or the same project or pulls out the transparencies. And I know what they were going for. But the downside is, at first, I legit felt guilty about iterating and improving projects from year to year. And then I didn't do a project in my third year, and I'd done it for 2 years before. I was like, I'm going to do something different. Yeah. And kids were upset because they'd heard about how good that project was. And I was like, oh, wait a second. Repeating projects
and it,
is allowed.
Should be encouraged. That's what I tell teachers. Like, hey, don't feel like you have to convert your entire curriculum to PBL the first year of trying it. Instead, what if you tried one project next spring? What if we spend our day today putting together the bones of a PBL project and then give you the tools to be able to go and work with your teams and really craft that thing? And then you launch it in the spring and you do just one PBL project. And then you make notes about what went well, what could be improved. And then you add another project next fall. And then you repeat that project the following spring. And then you add another project the following fall. Now you've got three PBL projects. And now you're starting to see why authenticity has such an impact on student engagement and deeper learning. And then all of a sudden, you're going to find you're going to want to do more PBL pieces. You're going to see kids get excited about it. And you're going to get excited about it. Right? Like, I mean, John, you told me about your mural project a number of times. And it's like, you seem to be just as fired up about your students creating a mural for your school as your students were. It's like, you love your work more.
Oh, I was. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And also, I think even when you do all of that and you get really into PBL, you also still say, not everything's PBL. Like you said, we're going to do some grammar practice. Or, hey, guess what? We're going to spend 25 minutes a day silently reading, and there's zero projects attached to it. We're going to read for the fun of reading. And that's okay, too. Like, there's something about saying PBL is what I love and what I'm into, but not 100%. Everything has to be PBL.
And yet, I think there's aspects of PBL that can be tied into a lot of stuff. You know, like you said, reading. I'm going to take the voice and choice component of PBL, and I'm going to add it to reading. So now students have choice in what they're reading. Or or I'm going to take the fun ending of a PBL project. I'm going to add that to reading a book together. And then at the end of it, we're going to do something fun to celebrate it. We're going to read the short story To Build a Fire. And we're going to do it the way that it's been read for 50 years. But then we're going to go outside and we're going to try to build a fire in the snow. Was there an authentic audience to it? No. Was there a problem given at the beginning of that story that we're going to try to solve? No. But we are going to have this fun climax to the learning experience, and we're going to try to build fires together. You know what I mean? Like, and by the way, we did that, and students love that more than any PBL project we ever did, right? Like, which is funny.
You know, and one of the, you know, I love your book, The Epic Classroom, you know, Confession, obviously.
I really love the publisher.
The publisher, like, you know, as a publisher, I got a sneak peek and I got to watch you revise it and improve it and continue to work on it through that whole process. But one of the things that stood out to me there was the power of story in PBL, which you've alluded to. And you have that sort of hero's journey, and that when they return, they are different. Right? They've come back with the elixir. And you are the guide that helped them find that elixir. You crafted that experience that helped them find that elixir. And the project may have worked. It may have not worked. It may have, you may do it better next year. You know, they may not have finished the project in some cases, right? Like, that happens. But if they came back with the elixir,
That's the goal.
The rest of it doesn't matter.
Exactly. Going back to my son's neighborhood project idea. Yeah, maybe it didn't have an authentic audience, an external audience, but at the end of it, he was better at collaborating. Right? That's part of the elixir. At the end of it, he was better at creativity and planning. He was better at shapes and mathematics for first graders, right? Like he was better at these things because he was engaged in this story, right? Like Joseph Campbell, the mythologist, he talks about the hero's journey. He says every story starts with a hero that exists in the known world. This is what the world looks like to them. But then there's a call to adventure, something that draws the hero out of the known into the unknown. And the unknown is hard. Right? That's where you experience challenges and obstacles. That's where you don't know how to operate. But then you experience guides or mentors, they're teachers that help you overcome those challenges. And when you overcome a challenge, you inevitably become stronger, right? And that's that elixir so that you can return back to the known world, a better version of yourself. And that's all PBL is. It's I'm going to give you a problem that matters, or I'm going to introduce something that I think is going to make you want to draw out of that known into the unknown. And you're going to overcome challenges and obstacles along the way. And hopefully you transform and you're a better version of yourself at the end of it. And that's what PBL is. That was your first question. What's PBL? That's all it is this learning experiences that transform.
Well, and I think something nobody tells you about those epic stories about Yoda or Dumbledore or whoever, right? Gandalf. Is the guide who helped the hero along the way. Is in the unknown.
Oh, that's good.
As well.
Uh-huh.
And I think something about doing PBL when you're a new teacher, when you're new to PBL, it all feels overwhelming and hard and different, right? The research has shown that that's one of the reasons why teachers abandon PBL is the sense of the unknown and the sense of like, I can't figure out how to make collaboration work, which you've talked into. I want to have a whole separate podcast on this at some point, have you on again to talk specifically because you've really nailed collaboration. Or I can't figure out completely how to match it to the standards perfectly, or I can't figure out where we're going, or I can't fit, you know, there's always these challenges and it feels unpredictable. And I think the beauty that you realize eventually is PBL is entering the unknown and the uncertainty, and that piece never goes away. And at some point, that becomes the fun of PBL as a teacher.
Yeah, I mean, what a perfect analogy. I never thought about that. Like, yeah, Dumbledore didn't know what was going to happen in the end with Harry and he who must not be named, right? Like,
yes, don't say it. Yeah, I have to edit that out of the podcast. You can't say Voldemort.
But like he didn't know, and it's so true. And you're like, I get the temptation to just pull out the same lesson plan and the same unit plan that you used your entire career. I get that because teaching's hard. And it's like, if you've got something that you know at least works in some way, why wouldn't you use it? And yet there's just this thing about PBL. But then really, if you zoom back, there's this thing about life that when we enter unknown spaces and we find out that we can thrive in them or succeed in them, despite being in the unknown, it does something for your human spirit. And as an educator, as a teacher, I just know that you know, thriving isn't always easy, but man, when you do, it feels so good, right? Like when your students create something that actually has a measurable difference on the society you live in your community, gosh, that feels good as a teacher. Or when you see a kid who, I mean, I've just seen it so many times, kids that are just counted out, right, by the system that they've been living in, and by the education system, that just feel like they're hopeless. And all of a sudden you see them walk across the graduation stage. Or you know, I had a student who, and she was just one of those students, and now she's a social worker who works directly with refugees. It's like when I get that email years later saying, hey, I'm a refugee social worker. It's like, man, that's some elixir. Right. Like that, there's something that just hearing that validation that made going into that unknown, messy space worth it. And that's why I keep doing it. You know, I work with pre-service teachers at a university class. Yeah. PBL is really hard with students who are in their senior year of college, because most of them have been in a very traditional, typical type of education experience their entire lives. And they're in their 16th year of education, and asking them to like, hey, get into groups and solve this problem together. It's like, yeah, that can get messy. That's mm-hmm. hard. That's really tough to manage. Mm-hmm. I get a lot of frustrated students. I'm sure you do too sometimes, where they're like, wait, you're not going to tell us who our group members are? Or like, wait a minute. I got to hold them accountable. You're not going to be the one to go and do that for me. Or, hey, wait a minute. There's a deadline and I got to present this in front of the provost of the university. Like, wait, what? It's like, yeah. And we're going to like send your work to Edutopia to try to get it published. You know, you're like, what? That amps up mm-hmm. the student work and their essays that they're writing. That amps up all these things. It can get messy. But man, when one of my students' work was actually published like for Ed Week or something like that, I was like, oh, this. Can I say a mild swear on your podcast or no? This was bad A. There we go. Like this is like why you do this. Yeah, like, yeah. And it just gets you fired up and makes you want to do it more. And that's, you know, I think that's part of my work as somebody who's trying to help educators adopt more of these, you know, type of learning practices. Is like, how do I get you to understand that this isn't a burden ultimately? This is something to enhance the work that you do. And I can only speak from personal experience and the testimony of many other people who've tried it that like, man, it just leads to inspired learning for everybody, the guide included.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Trevor. Where can people find you?
So you can check out my website at trevormuir.com. You can also find me all over social media, Facebook, The Epic Classroom. Is what we still call it there. And same with Instagram, The Epic Classroom, or on Twitter at Trevor Muir. And I'm not on TikTok. So I just missed that generation cutoff, but maybe someday.
Oh, I know. It's so funny. All the like TikTok / Instagram reel videos that there's all these songs that we now like just know in our house. So if something goes wrong, we're like, oh no. It's like this thing, you know, or we like this happy dog thing. Like there's all these things that it's invaded our house, even though none of us ourselves are on TikTok. And your two books are The Epic Classroom and The Collaborative Classroom, both excellent books. Please check them out if you have not checked them out yet. And like I said, I really want to have you back again to specifically speak to what collaboration looks like in the PBL classroom as well. But
yeah, man, thanks so much for having me on. This was fun. Bye, everybody.
So there you have it. That was Trevor Muir. He is a true PBL expert, a former project-based learning teacher who taught social studies and language arts. And I just want to say, if you enjoy this podcast, would you do me a huge favor? Would you leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts? That would mean the world to me. And tell a friend about this podcast if you find it to be helpful as well. Again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.